I think I'm speaking real hope that one day it will all be right. We will see things as they are, that life that's present at the core of everything will be so irrepressibly explosive that the entire cosmos changes. That's the strangeness and the glory of the Christian gospel, right? And it's the strangeness of poetry that we use the poetic method, the analogic method, the symbol making thing, the magic that is word and image, to find echoes of that now.
Paul J. Pastor is a poet and writer who lives in Oregon. He also serves as editor for two Christian imprints at Penguin Random House. We speak with him today about his remarkable recent collection of poems, Bower Lodge, which focuses exquisite attention on the natural world and discerns through it abundant traces of the divine. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Paul, Pastor, it's so great to see you. Thank you for joining me today on the Faith and Imagination podcast.
It is my pleasure to be here, Matthew. I'm so excited for our conversation.
I'm looking forward to this because your work is so provocative. And the collection of poems we're talking about, primarily Bower Lodge, is just so great. I begin, though, by asking guests about how faith informs our life and work. And I'm wondering whether you have a faith journey or a spiritual journey, or whether those things, in your case, are more diffusive and less easily narrated.
Can I say yes? Can I pick both?
Yeah,
I feel like it's both. I will cop out of the first question here. Yes, I do have a faith journey. I was not born into a house that had any recognizable faith. My parents were both very much in the spiritual but not religious category. And when I was in grade school, they had kind of a profound coming to Christianity that changed everything about life in a very, very quick manner. So growing up as a young boy, nothing of certainly formal faith was really part of my life. And then all of a sudden, we were cast into this very different world where, you know, we were attending church three times a week. And it was just it, like everything about life changed. And that was really profound and really beautiful. We came to faith in a more charismatic stream of Protestantism, which has its pluses and its minuses, but the warmth of that community was something that just really touched me and shaped me very deeply. And then, you know, this is kind of a long conversation about that growing up and about my boyhood and kind of becoming the person I am today, but my faith journey has really been shaped profoundly by books and by nature, the natural world. So I'm proudly and hopefully fairly humbly Christian. I love following Christ, but the way that I see and express that is very connected and very rooted to the life of creation and to the great tradition of Christians throughout history. I see myself in community with the centuries that have gone before me and with the centuries that will come after me, and as part of a real web of creation and life. So there is a sense of diffuse, it's a perfect word for it. It is diffused through kind of every place that I go. But there have been quite a few significant waypoints along the way, beginning with just coming to faith as a boy in grade school.
That's such a great answer to the question I put to you, Paul. I mean, so you and I have not met in person. I just know you through your work and your presence on social media. And for someone who only really has access to you through your work, there are three things to me that jump out about you, kind of like a little constellation of Paul Pastor. You're a poet, right, and a very fine poet. That's the first thing. You're religious, that's second. And you're also deeply attuned to the natural world. And those three things, the way you describe them, this larger conversation, I mean, would you say that one of those things is the natural conduit for the other two, poetry, religion, natural world, or they really only thought in relation to each other for you?
It's a really good question, but I actually think of them as one thing, as three branches of one thing. So poetry, faith, particularly Christian faith, and any sort of really thoughtful human engagement with nature is all about what we might term spirit with a small s. Another word for it might be essence, or another word might be nature, also with a small s. It's concerned with the core nature of things. Good poetry describes and gets to that core nature of its object or its focus of attention. And it's the same when you really have heartfelt faith. The power of spirituality is that it clarifies who you are. You do not become less of yourself, you become more of yourself. Beautiful image from the book of Revelation at the end of the New Testament, where Christ says that to the one who overcomes, he will give, and it's this very symbolic, poetic thing, a white stone on which is written a name that only God and the one to whom God gives it really knows. And it's this image of like, wow, at the end of the spiritual process, we will share this unspeakable secret, this good secret with our Creator. Just, it's so us that my imagination is just captured by this, that I would have that beautiful name. And I think of that as essence, as nature, as who I am. I am meant to fit into a slot, an empty space in the world by my Creator. And so even a rich, very human, very earthy, dirt under your fingernails connection with nature will teach you that lesson. If you walk attentively in the natural world, you will begin to see how everything is purely itself. A tree is not trying to be something other than a tree. A river cannot do anything but flow downwards, because that's the nature of water, to always be humble, to always flow downwards. A fire cannot do anything but go upwards, because that's the nature of fire. It must climb, it must go upwards. And so you begin to see yourself through those things. So to answer your question, I'm using a lot of words here, but to answer your question, I really do see those as three prongs of the same pitchfork, perhaps I could say, three branches of the same tree. It's the root reality of, you know, am I being clarified as a soul, as a spirit, as a person? And each of those are a way of understanding that and sort of grasping it.
What a wonderfully thoughtful answer to that question. I love your idea. I mean, first of all, the imagery of that white stone in Revelation is so striking. And then the examples about, you know, kind of a tree being a tree, the river being a river, fire being a fire, et cetera. Very, very striking. The idea that, you know, sort of spirit and recognition of the spiritual world makes us more and not less ourselves, I think, is really striking to me. It's a lot... Not that it's easy to live as that thing. I think inauthenticity is also easy in its way. But this all brings me, this thought about things becoming themselves really brings me to your really wonderful collection, Bower Lodge, because there's so many of the poems in there that speak to some facet of what you just described and do so in such striking and original and really thought-provoking ways. Let me ask you first about just the title. So Bower Lodge. Where and what? You know, yeah. So, I'm curious. It's a great image, and it comes up in a couple of poems. But could tell us about the title of the book first of all.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, the book has a very loose framing narrative. The basic idea is there's this very mysterious, enigmatic character, the beloved wanderer, who is moving sort of inevitably towards the Bower Lodge, towards this thing that you gradually get more and more clues about. But the basic idea is it's like a death lodge, like a traditional like death or a sweat lodge in an indigenous culture made of sticks. It's very strange, and it's set in the heart of this river. And so he's being led there by a lovely and implacable embalmer. And the wanderer simply knows that he's being taken to this place to die somehow, to fall asleep, to be changed. And so the book is really about these processes of inner transformation that get at precisely what you were just saying, the fact that inauthenticity is possible for humans. We alone, out of all nature, are able to be something other than ourselves, or at least to try to be. Yeah. And so there are certain stages and phases of the soul, I believe, that are a little bit to the inner life what puberty might be to the outer life. This inevitable change that comes upon you, the difference being, I do believe that there is a sense of choice. We can embrace that change, or we can turn away from that change. We can embrace the process of, a small inward death that teaches us something about ourselves and that clarifies something about ourselves, or we can turn away from it. So what I'm trying to draw attention to and to really praise in this collection and to honor in this collection is the bravery and the beauty that happens when you embrace going to what I call the Bower Lodge, the place where your work is to die, to fall asleep in some inward way, so that in faith, you might be changed and raised again to some semblance of new life. The New Testament calls this new creation. So this is a very, very obviously rich and certainly not original to me process, but that's the core image, this idea that the Bower Lodge is the place where that happens. And there's a path that goes to it, and there's a path that leads away. So it's a very strange, and I think beautiful central image for the collection.
Yeah, I agree, having read it. And it was such a compelling way, actually, to sort of think about this collection of poems. It actually raises two questions for me about them. First of all, I'm wondering whether you had the idea for that kind of larger mythic structure, and embalmer leading, kind of the beloved wanderer toward this lodge of transformation, or whether you found yourself writing poems and found they kind of cohered in a way that with a little more glue, a little more stucco, whatever, you could make them really correspond to something that would have this kind of mythic transformational journey quality to them.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm going to cheat again and say sort of both. My process of writing many of the core poems they weren't intentional in the form of like, I'm going to sit down now and choose the images that are going to come out of me. Like, I'm going to have this, real front of brain choice or craft about it. Like, the craft part for me really came in later in revision. But what I noticed was during this period of writing the majority of the book, these common images were coming out. And it's really interesting that, the bulk of this book was written, 2-3+ years ago. And as I return to it, even now to do readings or to prepare for today, I will see things and connections, genuine connections of image and of language that I did not consciously put in there. Instead, it was something that simply arose because it felt natural to the way that I had to write about it. It felt natural to the way I had to sing about it. So the collection always was itself, although I went through, probably 7 different versions of it as pieces came and pieces went and structure came and structure went. Yeah. Like, I really labored over the craftsmanship there. But at its core, it is something that sort of happened. Like, these images simply arose.
I love that you go back to it and see new things in it. I don't write poetry, although I probably missed my life calling. I would like to at least try writing poetry. When I'm in my 70s, Paul, I'll take up 2 hobbies. One is playing the cello. The other will be sort of trying to write poetry. Okay.
Oh, but don't wait.
I know, don't wait. You're exactly right. But I love that I could teach this book again and again and find new things that I had not seen the first time around. And I love that you as a writer have that same experience, these poems. Mm. Here's the second question I have then about that structure you put together. So the poet Abigail Carroll, she writes the foreword, and it's a very fine foreword to the book. And she says that the three parts, the collection's kind of written in 3 parts, right? And she says they correspond to Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Easter Sunday. But this isn't exactly kind of the Easter Triduum as we usually imagine it, and that we don't find ourselves directly in the Christ story. There aren't biblical characters and, that kind of thing. Mm. We aren't kind of walking, through the stations of the cross or anything like this. the connection's more evocative. Was this kind of Easter Friday, Holy Saturday, or I mean, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, Easter Sunday, was that conscious to you as you wrote it, or is that also a thing that kind of just seemed to be implicitly, latently there, waiting to be discovered by you as you wrote?
No, there was a high level of consciousness. There was a high level of consciousness for sure. And that's because I see each of those days, like in the life of Jesus and in the life of anyone who is following the path of Jesus, I see those days as each having a very specific and very different work. Like the work of Christ on Good Friday was to die, to faithfully die. And that required everything he had. It was, you know, it was the end. It was just incredibly difficult. And the work of Holy Saturday was to be dead. To be dead. And that is so difficult. The passivity of that, of resting in that in-between space is incredible. And then the work, of course, of Easter Sunday was to be raised, right? And each of those require a different type of surrender. It is interesting biblically that, you know, the Father raises the Son by means of the Holy Spirit, but it's an act of trust, you know, that Christ died and then is trusting that on the other side, resurrection is going to come. And so I see that as incredibly pregnant with meaning, that there are phases, if we are serious about following Jesus, where our work will be at some point to die or to be dead or to be raised. And so each section of the book, there are three linchpin poems titled Good Friday, another one titled Holy Saturday. Holy Saturday does feature Christ as he sort of descends, and it's a kind of a verbal icon of the harrowing of hell, which is this traditional Christian icon. And then the penultimate poem of the collection, Bauer Nest, Resurrection Day, features a resurrection scene. And so that is present there. But then the poems surrounding it are all dealing with the specific work that each of those days hold. So in that first section, you know, one of the lines in Bauer Lodge is, the work of death is dying. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot that's there. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, but
that's
it does.
Yep, that's how I think about it.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, there's so many great. We'll get to the poems, at least a few poems in the collection here in a minute. That's so rich. This could be a 5-hour podcast, Paul. You know, we kind of went poem by poem through.
I'm honored. Yeah, I'm honored by your attention.
No, it's such a beautiful. I'm gonna teach it in the future. This is gonna be on the list for me. One more comment. Let me ask you about it by Abigail Carroll, because it speaks to something that the book does, that the collection of poems does so well. She writes, and I'm going to quote her here, talking about your collection. No one comes through this journey unchanged. That is exactly the point. Here we become unblinded to the world's wonders. We face the unraveling of the self that is death, and we overhear unspeakable glory, the monstrously beautiful noise of all things becoming themselves. Mm. Okay, there's so much in that. We'll get to more of this a little later in our conversation, but you refer to monstrous beauty in poems late in the collection. I'm curious about that conjunction of these seemingly conflicting impressions,
yes,
the monstrous
yes.
and the beautiful. It's an underwriting feature of so many of the poems in here. Can you tell me about that conflation of conflicting impressions?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We're back to the question at the beginning about poetry, religion, and nature. Each of those, if done well, is monstrously beautiful. I see the work of the writer as telling the truth. My job, if I am to be faithful, is to tell the truth. And, you know, many people, we'll just use nature as the example here. Many people have this very idealized version of nature and the natural world that's only possible if you're a bit disconnected from it. This is the vision of the natural world that takes place in like a city park where there's this beautiful tree and the mown grass and all this stuff. But real ecosystems are this constant roiling of death and life in these really absurd, unexplainable and grotesque beauties. I mean, it's walking into the woods. Just last week, I walked into the woods and I found the bones of a fawn that were scattered over, you know, perhaps a 12-foot area. Wow. And it was obviously a very young deer, and each bone had been meticulously chewed by by rats, I think, so that there were all of these patterns, almost looked like carved wood across each of the bones. And from this little portion of the skull, there was sprouting, there was a snail shell next to it, an empty snail shell, and there was sprouting a little mushroom. And it was this like still alive scene of truly horrible, gorgeous beauty. And it's like, that's real life. The fact that this innocent young creature, for reasons unknown to me, died and then was consumed by its environment, every single bit of it feeding something. And, you know, the idea of decomposition or of things that live in context of decomposition is one of the sub-themes of Bower Lodge. I try to draw attention to flies and to maggots, and that's not to be grotesque and it's not to be shocking or grim. It's because there is a certain beauty to the role that such things play. The message that they send is nothing is wasted. Even your death and your total loss, even that won't be wasted. We will use this. We will take this. We will pass this along. You will become soil. And that's a hard mystery for us to understand. But it's part of the language of God for whatever reason. Carbon-based life goes through these transformations. We just do. And so telling the truth about that, I think, is a bit like looking at the gospel from the underside, right?
Great image.
Life is death. Death is life. Up is down. You give up everything to find yourself.
Right.
That counterintuitive nature is present in the natural world. And the degree to which we understand that and can celebrate it and can embrace it really is a degree to which we become free as people and as spiritual beings. And as artists and as writers in particular, we become free to tell the whole truth. And that is a good thing. So yeah, I think that's how I'd answer that question. That beauty is often monstrous and monstrosity is occasionally beautiful. And poetry and faith and nature hold those things naturally in balance.
That's such a provocative answer. And the image that you kind of give rise to those thoughts of that fawn, you know, with the rats having created kind of a filigree on the bones. It's such a compelling image. Thank you for that, that thought. I want to ask you about some poems in the collection. We've got, I don't know, 25-ish minutes to talk about them, which is not enough time, but hopefully get to four or five of these. And I'd love to get kind of some insight of yours into this. Let me take one poem that seems kind of like, in some ways, really indicative of the volume as a whole, talking about the challenge of seeing. This is Nine Kinds of Blindness. It's on page 34. I wonder, would you read this poem for us?
Yes, I'd love to.
Thank you.
Nine Kinds of Blindness. One, the one where your eyes do not work to see anything. Two, the one where your eyes do not work to see everything. Three, the one where your eyes work, but you cannot see what you have never seen before. Four, the one where your eyes work, but you cannot see what is inconvenient. Five, the one where your eyes work, but someone is keeping you from using them. Six, the one where your eyes work, but you are angry. Seven, the one where your eyes work, but you are afraid. Eight, the one where your eyes work, but there is no light. Nine, the one where your eyes work, but there is nothing but light.
That's great. You know, the poem strikes me because so much of poetry, I think especially this is very evident in your work, is about helping us see things to which we might otherwise be blind or obtuse or just not grasping. But as you point out in the poem, seeing's a challenge because there are so many different ways we can miss things. In fact, I love that these nine kinds of blindness, seven involve eyes that work. Right, which seems very telling to me. And I'm interested in a couple of these, for example, you know, the 8 to 9, right? Mm-hmm. The one where your eyes work, but there is no light. And then the one mm-hmm. where your eyes work, but there is nothing but light. Mm-hmm. This suggests that we only see in partial light, which is, mm-hmm. for me, raises the question of what it even means to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you know, one of the strangest teachings of Christ is that you can have eyes and not be able to see, right? Those yeah. with eyes to see and those with ears to hear is one of the most haunting teachings of Jesus. I'll just never get over it. And so that's undoubtedly in the background of this piece for me. And yeah, I do think, you know, pure light doesn't work for human eyes. And I don't understand how all of that fully will sort itself out at the end of all things, but we need some measure of darkness. And the interesting thing, I'm talking a lot about the life of Jesus here, just cause, but it strikes me, how could we have known Christ the healer unless there had been the lepers and the blind around him? Even with Lazarus, you know, that teaching where this happened, that, you know, the glory of God might be revealed. It's way above my pay grade to say much about the theology there, but I'm a poet. My job is to tell the truth. And I think that there is something true in that idea, that there has to be some measure of shadow for us to be able to see anything. And I guess I'll just leave it at that. You know, it's possible to be blind when there's no light, and it's possible to be blind because there's nothing but light.
Yeah, that's great. Isn't it John chapter 9, the story about the healing of the blind man, right? Where at the end of it, I think it's this story and not elsewhere, but Christ's words are to his enemies. He says that if they were to admit their blindness, then they wouldn't be guilty. But they say, we see, and therefore their sin remains.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which is Christ saying, you're not seeing. If you knew you were blind, if you had the vision for your blindness, you'd be okay. Having no vision, though, for the fact that you're blind, that right there is the sin.
Yeah.
There's another poem in here that also talks about attention, seeing things and not seeing them at first. It's the poem Bee Tree, page 48. Would you read this one again for us? I'm not trying to push. I'll read these too, but it's nice that the poet read, you know, his own work here.
I'd love to do it. Yeah. Bee tree. I nearly cut it down twice. It is dead, or was dead, but my saw was dull and I felt lazy. Today I sat back in a chair beside the woods and saw them. High, 20 feet up, perhaps, like a droning school of fish. Tiny, golden in the sun. One by one, in and out, and in.
It's a great poem. You know what I love about this? So a few minutes ago, you gave that really provocative thought that kind of began with that image of the fawn that you come across, right? The thought about kind of monstrous beauty and death and life and life and death. And that's, you know, that image gives rise to a thought and that response. But here, you know, the poem just concludes with the attention to seeing getting really simple. It's not as though the seeing of the bees in the tree gives rise to a thought that you philosophize about the nature, what it means to see. Just, you know, tiny, golden in the sun, one by one, in and out, and in. It should be focuses attention right there. You know, a poem brings attention then to that, an otherwise unremarkable fact of nature, but really striking, to actually take note of it. It becomes remarkable by virtue of its attention. I mean, was that a conscious, for you, part of the process of what this poem was producing, or part of the end result to sort of bring attention to the importance of attention itself?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if it was conscious, but I do think it's a really important work. And one of the things I note about this poem at the end is the connection with breathing, the in and out and in. There's a respiration there that happens. Yeah. And so that idea that, you know, I'm sort of, and literally this comes from looking out through my window, and there's this massive alder, actually the same alder that I write about in Birdsap elsewhere in the collection, that has died, a large, large tree, and watching the bees use it and find a home in it, and just thinking, if it was alive, that could not happen. This gift to them came only because this great tree died. But now it's taking on the second life. Now it's breathing. And in terms of attention, I just think it's time spent in the proximity of things that are larger than you that kind of command that attention and draw that attention magnetically.
You know, sometimes it seems we can see almost too much, or perhaps read too much into a situation, impose maybe a little bit onto the situation, or fail, therefore, to see things for what they are. And for me, at least, and maybe you can correct me if you didn't see this way at all, but maybe I'm reading too much into this poem, but the poem on the next page, The Potato Diggers, brings this to mind. Maybe I'll read this one and you tell me
please.
About this poem.
Yeah, please, yeah. Absolutely.
The Potato Diggers. Turned up a skull with buds curling in the eye sockets. They rolled it with a spade, uncomprehending, until the jaw fell off. Then one fainted. One ran to ring the cops. One left yawning to dig elsewhere. And one looked at me, accusing, for he knew he was in a scene of someone's making, and no matter what he did, it would become a symbol. Now, I find that so provocative, that this one in a scene of someone's making, and that sense of indignity of being reduced or perhaps inflated to the status of a symbol, it's such a striking way to end the poem. Right, the not with the skull, but the concern of one who's being, you know, conscripted into a story not of his own making. Can you tell me about this poem, what you see in it, what its inception was, or what you're kind of doing in there?
Yeah, it's about responses to the monstrous beauty. You know, they're out digging for food. They turn up a skull, and in the eye sockets are buds. There's something growing from it. Nature is eating that death. And then there's the responses, outrage, indignant responses, all of that. And then the last one is a bit of, you know, where I saw myself in the writing of this poem, and where, you know, kind of anyone who experiences significant loss. Part of my story is, you know, the loss of a brother when I was in grade school, very young, and I was very connected to his process of death, and then the hours afterwards, and just all of that made a very deep impression on me. And there is this sense of like commingled resignation and indignation that accompanies the presence of that in someone's life. And so, we all respond to the uncovering of death in these different ways. You know, there we are going about our life, and then all of a sudden there's the turn of a spade and we're faced with it. This is what is. And so I suppose the piece is just about capturing the feeling, that feeling of looking upwards, kind of breaking the fourth wall towards whoever it is that's writing this story and being like, wait, what? What the heck? So I'm a bit playing God, I suppose, on the page of making these characters do that, and then having one break the fourth wall and really look at me and look at the reader as well. Knowing that he has become a symbol for what? I'll let the readers decide for what, but that's a bit about that piece.
Okay, that's really provocative. It's, you know, I've got to say, here's something that you and I have in common. When I was in grade school, I had a brother who died. I was 7, he was 5. You know, I got chicken pox, I gave it to him, and he was being treated, and anyway, it turned into a really severe brain disease. these days very treatable, you know, almost 50 years ago, not so much. Anyway, he died. And that was a hugely impactful part of my childhood. In fact, my entire coming of age after that, very much shaped by that event in ways that was first unconscious to me and eventually more conscious. You know,
We absolutely share that. And undoubtedly, the, you know, there's something very specific about that kind of loss. That's just very, especially at that age, that's very different. You understand that you live in a world where anything is possible, not necessarily in a good way, but all bets are off. This is the real thing. And ultimately, I see how it belongs. I see in its way, it was a gift. Not that I would ever have chosen that, but it belongs. And part of that belonging is, you know, being forced to see what is. This is what is. And not everyone is privileged enough. What is it that T.S. Eliot writes in the beginning of the Four Quartets? The bird says, human beings cannot bear very much reality.
Right.
Isn't that right? I'm quoting
exactly
that from memory, so it might not be perfect.
Exactly right.
Human beings cannot bear very much reality.
Humankind cannot bear very much reality.
Yes. Thank you. So I guess we need practice. We need practice with that reality.
Yeah, we do. Thank you for sharing that. Let me move from seeing to a different kind of sensation, that of feeling lured or drawn, and kind of the feeling of desire. You know, your poem, The Snags, describes and even has a message for fish, but that message seems very applicable to its human readers. This is on page 84, The Snags. Would you read this poem for us? It's a wonderful poem. These all of them, but this is redundant. It's a wonderful poem, but they all are. But nevertheless, let's talk this one through a little bit.
Great. The Snags. Old lures hung by winter flood, tangle tilted alders. From the brown pool, trout watch them spin. Puckered spoons, delicately strung, monofilamental, ornamented. Pink and vicious fuzz, treble hooks, rooster tails, imitation frogs, whose limbs thump bass challenges to those who hunger in the speckled water, who swim oblique in sundry variegations, aching to rise for bright painted things, the impossible fruit of the alder, neon tidbits of eternal beauty. Little fish, remember what hangs bright beyond your reach, the knowledge that would pierce you with its horrid loveliness, pull you thrilled, protesting, gooped and bloody at the gills, into the air.
You know, I love the precise beauty of so many images in that opening stanza. These puckered spoons, delicately strung, monofilamental, ornamented, pink and vicious fuzz, and so on and so on. You know, likewise, I love the description of the fish. It's very striking. Those who hunger in the speckled water, right? Creatures who ache to rise for bright painted things, neon tidbits of eternal beauty. You know, in that last line, it seems, we're already leaving description for something like allegory, which becomes, at least that's how I would read it, becomes more apparent in the second stanza when you address the fish directly. So the poem's appeal to the knowledge that would pierce you with its horrid loveliness, like a fish hook, pulling one thrilled, protesting, gooped, and bloody at the gills into the air. I've got to ask you, what prompted that really extraordinary thought, this equation of fish with our attraction to forbidden knowledge?
Well, the forbidden knowledge here is good knowledge. That's one thing that I really want to stress. There are several different poems in the collection where fish come out of the water. The obelisk one, where the fish is thrown high up on the sand, gasping in broad ecstasy. My God, why have you forsaken me? Then as well, a leaping salmon falling back to water is another really key one. And so this image of, this image of fish leaving their element is important. And it's equated with spiritual ascent. It's equated with going up. And so the forbidden knowledge here, I think, is the desire that we have for some level of perspective. I don't want to unpack the metaphor too much because I'm afraid that it'll collapse if I squeeze it too hard. But I'm really intrigued by the idea that, you know, we want so badly to know the whys of life, to know the hows of life. And once in a while, like a leaping salmon, we can exit our element and see. Like that particular poem, I think, sheds a lot of light on this one, where this salmon is leaping from the water and is seeing, kind of for the first time, the world above his world. But the salmon can't live there yet. The salmon can't live there yet. And if he tried, he'd be that fish in the obelisk poem that's cast, you know, for whom the foreign element is death, I think is the line that's there. And so this is, you know, there's a lot of temptation to be pulled up and out of the world where we're meant to live, the world of our element. And we can vacation there, but it's not a place that we're ready to live yet. We can't breathe that yet. And so I think part of the message of this piece is don't be tempted too much by things that are pulling you up. Mm. Be content. Grow on your schedule, and wait, because at the end you will be taken out of the river. You know, there is a resolution coming, even in the collection towards the end. But don't rush to that if you're not ready for it.
Yeah, that's right. Good. You know, I recently spoke on this podcast with Alice Freiling. She's a spiritual writer and director who published a very thoughtful book about aging. And she speaks in that book about the losses that accompany age, which is something I'm feeling increasingly, you know, in my mid-50s. But she also quotes Richard Rohr, who writes that saintly people all die many times before the end of their lives. Mm-hmm. And that theme on which she writes, that we need loss, we need to die to some things in order to become ourselves, is in some ways at the core of your poem, Man's Size, which I love. And I wonder, I'd love to get your insights onto that idea, onto the poem there, Man's Size, page 119 is where it is. Let me read this one, and then I'd love your thoughts on it. All these are so great. Here's Man's Size. I then came to know myself. By the way, I love that you begin, I then came, as though we're kind of at the back end of a story. This is great. Anyway, I'll start over again. Okay. I then came to know myself, not as carver, but as statue under mallet's arc, half face, lop lumped, pushing from new marble, who only gained his eyes when flakes fell that had been his cheeks. Whose brow, furrowed or relaxed as chisel chipped, who gained features by subtraction of what he thought he was. Yes, my block used to be so much something. I was nothing, slab of rigid possibility, stone that could not live until potential had all been chunked away. You know, it's great. And when we think of becoming ourselves, we usually do so in terms of realizing potential, not having potential chunked away from us. That's such a great way you get at this idea that we become through loss and not just through accumulation. Can you talk about that poem for me?
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, my wife and I have a phrase that we love to use. We call it the holy no. And we actually use it with scheduling a lot. Because, you know, we're busy people. We have three kids, you know, we're both, you know, doing our lives. And so we realized perhaps a decade ago that we were saying too many yeses, and the yeses were getting in the way of one another, and that we had to practice something very hard for us to do, and that was saying no. And so we sort of consecrated that and said, you know, we're going to have a holy no. There's going to be a no that we say that gives space for something else to be. And so that's a lot of the spirit that animates this, just that image. I think it was Michelangelo who said, you know, you chip away everything other than the statue, and the statue is what's left, right? You just, carving a statue is not difficult. You just carve away everything that doesn't belong. And of course, that's Michelangelo. But
right.
But there's something to that, you know? Every loss of a smaller version of myself, every time that I've realized, you know, I'm not that. I'm not this. You know, especially when you're younger, you think I can grow up and be anything. And then life fairly quickly disabuses you of that notion. But in that, there's a freedom. It's okay that I can't be anything, because with each of those lost opportunities or, you know, potential, just that sense of self-changing, you gain a little bit more of what you really are. And there is such freedom in that and such beauty in that, that I think I think it's great. And, you know, originally, the original version of this poem repeated at the very end that initial line, I then came to know myself. And part of me still likes that version, where it really highlights, yes, this is what it takes to know yourself. It's not more. It's less. It's not the yeses. It's the holy noes. And that's obviously not the whole truth, but it is a truth that I think that we need to focus on. So yeah, that's a significant part of where this piece came from. It's just that experience of, you know, understanding yourself by means of what you can't or won't become.
Oh, that's great. And by the way, I think that would have been a great ending, but I've got to say, I like the ending in here because it chunks away that line's repetition at the end. It makes it more sort of evocative, right? And not so much stated outright. And it's a beautiful poem. I'm at the age now where I'm experiencing a lot, very poignantly, the reality of a lot of things that I won't be or become. I might have become anything, I say to myself now, but not going forward. There are things that I am. I'm very grateful for the life that I have, but it is one where you start to realize a lot of my life has been about things being chunked away, and more will be chunked away as the years pass. That's all right, but it does require kind of a rigid, almost stone-like ability to sort of face the reality of the you know, the losses that still remain to be faced. Attempt for one more poem. We're going to go longer than we usually do anyway with this podcast, because it's, by the way, thank you, by the way, for not giving me the holy no when I invite you to come on here and talk.
Of course. No, really, I'm very honored. I'm very honored by your excitement about this collection. And I think it's beautiful that we get to speak today.
Yeah. Can we read the poem Prophecy? This is on page 128. This poem kind of brings a lot of things together for me in the collection. Would you read this poem for us, and we can talk about it for a couple minutes?
I'd love to. Prophecy. In the last days, every particle of sun will sing crucifixion. Leaves of lost books fluttering in wind will flip and blur, spelling the great name whose trumpet tones, Christ Jesus, will roar like burning wool, like waterfalls that wear stone hearts to grit with everlasting judgments and compassions. And I say, for I have seen it, that the wound in my left arm will speak mysteries as a small mouth, that tears bottled by vintages and years will come uncorked, foaming golden, gushing goblets for the wedding, that all things shall become themselves in the flowered antecedent glory, an unspeakable praise that would be monstrous, if not perfect in its goodness and kaleidoscopic beauty, turning, arranging new geometries, turning, clicking colors upon colors.
What a beautiful poem. You know, and you mentioned earlier that image from Revelation of that white stone. And when I read this line about tears bottled by vintages and years will come uncorked, I thought about that line of Revelation about tears being wiped, all tears wiped away from all eyes, you know. This poem, so striking about things becoming themselves because they're also part of a larger orchestra that sings Christ's name. Can you tell us a bit about this poem and what you're doing in it?
Yeah, I think I'm speaking hope to myself.
Yeah.
Real hope that one day it will all be right. We will see things as they are, that life that's present at the core of everything will be so irrepressibly explosive that the entire cosmos changes. That's the strangeness and the glory of the Christian gospel, right? And it's the strangeness of poetry that we use the poetic method, the analogic method, the symbol-making thing, the magic that is word and image, to find echoes of that now, to find evidences of that now. You know, the Eastern Orthodox have a really, really beautiful doctrine that in church we are experiencing a time beyond time, and that the community of Christians are not people of the past, they are the people of the future. And I think that of the poets as well. We are not people of the past, we are people of the future. And so that's why the prophecy language just, I think, works so well for it, because we can see now, like the visionary prophets of old, we can see through the way things are to the way things will be. We can see through the appearance to the essence. We can see through the veil to the face beneath the veil. And that's such a huge part of the work of being a human. Is to exercise that capacity for sight. And if we don't have it, then to turn to people who do and say, what do you see? Tell me so that I might live in that light. Yeah, so I think that's a few of the things that are going on in this piece. Just the idea that the incredible, dense, complex, evolving beauty of the future can be glimpsed now, can be present now, can be grasped now, and that it's really good.
That's beautiful. In the couple of minutes that remain, let me ask you about poetry generally here. Mm-hmm. Is the kind of poetry you just described for us, you know, the kind of poetry to which you're drawn, would you say that the poetry to which you're drawn is also the kind of poetry that you find yourself creating? Or are those two things a little bit different?
Yeah. So I think about poetry kind of originating from one of three different places. I think a lot about knowledge and poetry as a means of knowledge. And so if you hang around me and talk poetry for any length of time, you'll probably hear me say something like, there's three structures in the human body that have neural networks, like information transfer networks, the brain, the heart, and the gut. And those sort of correspond in my poetics to ways of thinking, ways of loving or feeling, and ways of intuiting, each of which is a different type of knowledge. So I would describe myself largely as a poet of the gut. So I would see myself as, you know, in company with writers like John Haynes or like Robert Bly, who have this very gut forward sense of image. And I admire that colossally, but there are absolutely poets of the heart and poets of the head. T.S. Eliot is, you know, an idol of mine, a poetic idol of mine. He's completely a poet of the head.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely, a philosopher. And so I do aspire to that. And I do write in more holistic styles. Bower Lodge is very much a gut collection. It's a book of the gut. But I do have capacity for other types of work, and I'm actually doing quite a bit of other types of work right now on you know, some other works in progress. So you'll definitely see more. But I'm drawn really to excellence in all three of those domains. And many of the poets that I enjoy include, you know, Diane Seuss, who's certainly incredible, Marley Yeomans, Abigail Carroll is another one, and Leslie Williams, both of whom I just colossally admire. So, and then, you know, quite a few of the classics. Eliot, for sure, is a huge influence on me. But yeah, I guess that's how I think about it.
I love the head, heart, and gut being a way to sort of imagine different kinds of poems. It's really a provocative way to characterize the different ways that poets can know things and speak to experience about things. Would you say that in 10 or 20 years, you'll be producing still, you imagine, poems of the gut? Will the gut have evolved to be something different? Or do you see yourself kind of shifting? Can you imagine yourself speculatively shifting gears?
Yeah, I think that based on what I'm writing now, I will continue to write a lot of material like what's in Bower Lodge. Like, you know, short poetry is certainly going to be there. But I have a tremendous interest, Matthew, in narrative poetry and in epic poetry, which is a form that's really largely been lost to our day. But it is, you know, if you look through history, it's sort of the default mode for poets. The Nordic bards, Homer, Dante, Ezra Pound sort of attempted it in the Cantos, but you know, he was too much a poet of the head. He lost his heart along the way. Yeah. So my ambition is to craft some very large work, some big things. And part of the difficulty of that is, in order to pull it off, in order to sustain that type of thing, you really do have to engage each of those three domains that I mentioned. You have to have the capacity to think through your project excellently and to execute it with a very high level of skill and craft, or people will simply lose interest. You have to have an emotional core that carries somebody through and paces them through the collection, or people will lose interest. And you have to have an intuitive sense for the imagery and the stuff of dreams that great poetry is made of, that inexpressible, I never could have thought of that element that a really strong poet brings into his or her work. And that comes from the gut. That's gut stuff. You have to bring all those domains together. So I would love to one day have the skill and the capacity to do that. I'm working hard towards that. I don't know whether my skill or abilities will be able to do so. If not, okay, that's fine. But that is my ambition and my aspiration, is to be able to do some very large projects that have that kind of scale and that type of narrative core that I'm just really drawn to.
Okay, well, some future day when I'm either learning the cello or writing a few poems myself, I look forward to reading those epic length poems of yours. Those sound amazing. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. This has been so wonderful to hear your thoughts on this, really enlightening for me. I've learned a lot about not just your work, but about poetry and about poetry's ways, really poetry as an instrument of knowledge and understanding. Mm-hmm. I really love your work and look forward to reading more of it. So thank you so much.
Matthew, thank you. Your generosity and your kindness and your creativity here are just exemplary. What a beautiful interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.